Clive Bull on LBC.
Good morning, it's LBC, and I'm with you through till four. Now, we're going to talk more about Donald Trump, what he's been saying about Ukraine and the planned meeting with Vladimir Putin in Saudi Arabia to discuss peace negotiations. We're going to cross now to Washington and talk to our US correspondent, Simon Marks, who joins us. So, Simon, another extraordinary day in the US.
Yeah, absolutely, Clive. I mean, with the revelation early this morning that President Trump had spent 90 minutes on the telephone with Vladimir Putin. I mean, when one thinks of the events of the last several hours, it all kind of makes sense. That sudden announcement on Tuesday that Donald Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, had gone to Russia to broker the release from prison there of a Pennsylvania school teacher who had been convicted of drugs possession, had spent 3.5 years in a Russian jail, finally was out of the country, showed up at the White House on Tuesday night, met President Trump and thanked him and his entire entourage of national security advisors for the work that they had done securing his release. Then we got word that a Russian was being released from an American jail, part of an exchange that began to unfold over subsequent hours. In that case, it was a Russian who had been convicted of cybercrime being returned home to Russia. And of course, throughout the day on Tuesday, President Trump had made several media appearances, that extraordinary one flanked by Elon Musk in the Oval Office with Elon Musk's 4-year-old son, X, present. And at one point, reporters had asked Donald Trump, as they do from time to time, whether he had spoken to Vladimir Putin. He was then asked again last on Tuesday night when he met Mark Fogel, the returning and released former now inmate in Russia's jails, whether he'd spoken to Vladimir Putin, and he played very cagey with the answer to that question. We then learnt today that the two men had spoken on Wednesday morning for 90 minutes, and in a social media post published on his own social media platform, Donald Trump said that the conversation had been highly productive and revealed that he had secured the Russian president's commitment to engage in peace negotiations starting immediately to bring about an end to the conflict that Donald Trump likes to call the ridiculous war in Ukraine. What was extraordinary about this is that he put it out over social media before calling Russian Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Indeed, many observers here find it pretty extraordinary that the first person he called was Vladimir Putin, the aggressor, rather than Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine, a 30-year allied nation of the United States, and very much, of course, the aggrieved party in this conflict. And that was the first of many indications that President Trump is essentially saying to Volodymyr Zelensky, I've sealed your fate even before these peace talks begin. I mean, there was the nature of the communication today, confirmation by the White House that President Trump had set absolutely no preconditions for Vladimir Putin to engage in negotiations, no cessation of hostilities, no military withdrawal required. Then came word of the delegation from the United States that is going to lead these peace negotiations, made up of four people, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, the CIA Director John Ratcliffe, National Security Advisor Michael Waltz, and Special Envoy Steve Witkoff. Notably absent from that list, General Keith Kellogg, who only a few weeks ago was named by Donald Trump as his special envoy to bring about peace in Ukraine. It now seems that the Russians objected to General Kellogg. He is, after all, a career military man. He knows a thing or two about foreign policy and defense. They didn't want him involved in this process. So now it's going to fall to these other people to oversee it. And, of course, no European governments other than Ukraine and Russia are going to be involved in this negotiation. It's going to be a straight three-way negotiation, and Ukrainians, I think, will argue that that is gaming the whole thing against them and tilting it in Russia's favor, especially because we know the outcome that Donald Trump is seeking. He wants Ukraine to cede territory to Russia, certainly the Crimea that was annexed by Vladimir Putin during the Obama presidency, and almost certainly chunks of eastern Ukraine that Russia currently occupies around the regions and cities of Donetsk and Luhansk, which will be seen by many in the foreign policy establishment here, if that's the way things come to pass, as a big win for Vladimir Putin, and something that only might embolden him in the future to pursue other military adventures in Europe. And this is going to be a Europe that we also learnt today from Defence Secretary Pete Hegseth that is not necessarily going to be able to rely on America's absolute attention and traditional NATO protection as it has done in the past, because he firmly indicated President Trump wants to get disentangled from Europe and be freed to shift his focus to other parts of the world, particularly the Asia-Pacific region and Chinese expansionism. So a very big day.
Yes, and I imagine, though, it might have gone down quite well with some of the US public. They might think, well, good, actually, we're putting all this money and effort into a war and we don't want to.
Yeah, no question about that. And they may also approve of President Trump's determination to try and get Ukraine to pay for all of the military and other assistance that it was provided by the Biden administration during the course of this war. Donald Trump wants them to pay for that by giving America access to rare earths, these highly valuable prized mineral resources that lie in Ukrainian soil. Many of them, interestingly, in the eastern part of Ukraine that Russia is currently occupying. The Treasury Secretary of the United States visited Kyiv earlier this week to present a preliminary plan in that regard to President Volodymyr Zelensky. So the idea is not only to strip Ukraine of some territory. The idea is also to strip Ukraine of some of its natural resources to pay America back for the millions and millions and millions of dollars in military assistance that has been provided to them during the course of the war. And again, that may prove popular with Americans who say, well, quite right, we should get some of that money back. Many of them, of course, 77 million of them, backed Donald Trump's American election campaign approach, which argued that the Biden administration was much more concerned about Ukraine's border with Russia than it was about the illegal immigration crisis on America's southern border with Mexico. So this may well prove popular with Americans at home who favor a more isolationist approach to foreign policy, but it equally is definitely something that should be putting the wind up governments in Europe, because Donald Trump is essentially pricing America's NATO commitment, Article 5 commitment. You know, an attack on one is an attack on all, the mutual defense covenants that lie at the heart of the NATO charter. He's basically pricing that out of the market. He initially wanted all European nations, including the UK, to devote 2.5% of their GDP to defense expenditure. Now that number's gone up to 5%. Maybe it'll go up even higher. And if they don't meet that number, Donald Trump increasingly looks set to say, as he indicated before, that, you know, if a country is attacked by Russia in the future and they at that point hadn't met the 2.5% GDP, he would not necessarily decide to come to their aid. So this is a huge shift. I mean, it's not only potentially redrawing the map of Europe as far as Ukraine is concerned, it's a huge foreign and defense policy shift, ending potentially 80 years of America's commitment to defending Europe in the case of hostile attack.
And can I just ask you more broadly, as you said at the beginning, it's never a dull day. There's just announcement after announcement. It's like a blitz of policies. He, you know, to coin a phrase, he has hit the ground running. What's going on here? Do you think he's got to do it all very quickly before he runs out of time? Is he trying to prove a point that maybe he couldn't do before?
Yes, I think he's definitely trying to do that. And he's gamed things strategically so that this time round, unlike his first term in office, he's not surrounded by restraining influences. You know, Washington careerists, experts, specialists in policy who say, Mr. President, you can't just go out there and announce that you're taking over the Gaza Strip. Don't be crazy. We'll have to go away and think about that. They're not around. They are not in the room. They are not in the government and they are not going to be brought into the government. And I think that what we're seeing here is a move by Donald Trump essentially to move so quickly that his critics, his opponents, and the guardrails of the American Constitution cannot keep up with him. I mean, this is deliberate strategy. They talked about doing this, the architects of Project 2025 in the run-up to Election Day last year. This is about flooding the zone, a whole array of executive orders being signed every single day on a wide range of topics that leave Donald Trump's critics and his opponents and the media and the courts and the lawyers absolutely playing catch-up mode all the time. It's interesting that in this flurry of activity, Clive, as the fabulous Ed Luce, the Financial Times commentator here, points out in the Wednesday edition of the newspaper, Donald Trump hasn't sent a single piece of legislation to Capitol Hill. He hasn't submitted a single proposal for new law to the members of Congress who would debate and enact that law. Everything is being done by executive order, by diktat, and he wants a confrontation with the courts to see just how far he's going to be allowed to go. And the big question here this week, additional to everything we've talked about in foreign policy terms, is will Donald Trump adhere to court rulings when judges tell him and Elon Musk, his de facto prime minister, that they are not allowed to do the things that they are doing? And the early indications, even though Donald Trump denies it, are that the president may actually steamroller legal judgments and just get on and do the things that he wants to do. And that will be a real major constitutional crisis in a country where Congress, because of the Republican majorities up there, are supine. The media, you know, you look at the composition of the press at the White House, he's brought all of these far right leaning news organizations in to cover events daily at the White House, the Pentagon and the State Department, the Associated Press, the most revered national wire service in the United States, is still being banned from attending White House events because they won't rename the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. I mean, that is how far he is willing to push things in a bid to see just how much power an all-powerful executive presidency in the United States under President Trump and Elon Musk are going to be allowed to get away with.
Simon, thank you very much indeed. Simon Marks there, our US correspondent.